is the rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Coming up on the show, WUFT's environmental reporter Rose Schnabel brings us a story of climate migration for NPR's Climate Solutions Week. And later, whether they're smushed on your car bumper or crawling on your leg, love bugs are here this week. We talk to an entomologist about how to avoid them. But first, going to jail is a scary situation, but for many, what's even scarier is the unknown of what to do after getting released. Navigating the transition between incarceration and the free world is difficult. Released Reentry is an Alachua County nonprofit organization that aims to make this process easier and reduce reoffending. Emily Westerholm is the director. WUFT's Stryker Anderson spoke with her earlier about the initiative, and she explained how it came to be.
I was incarcerated myself back in 1997 in Texas for a very brief amount of time, but it was long enough to know how dehumanizing the experience of incarceration is, even if it's one night in jail or three decades in prison. So it didn't happen overnight, but eventually I went back to school and I became a substance abuse counselor first, with the intention to go back inside and teach and be, you know, counsel folks who were struggling with substance use disorders. So I did that.
Westerholm worked for multiple nonprofits focusing on reentry education and support for over a decade before coming to Gainesville.
So I used kind of my research and academic expertise as well as my lived experience and professional experience to start this organization.
If you could just walk me through just a few of the main services you offer, some of the services that you see get utilized the most.
Everything is voluntary. One of the things that's stripped away from people when they're incarcerated is that sense of autonomy and free will. A lot of folks are also on probation, and in probation, you don't have a whole lot of options. So we like to really just let people decide how they want to triage their needs. Sometimes that's employment. Sometimes it's I just need someone to teach me how to get on email. Sometimes we, you know, our biggest services that we utilize are definitely employment navigation, peer support, mental health navigation and support.
So when you came to the community, they didn't have a reentry program. What did you see that made you really want to further this initiative?
I definitely kept hearing, what am I supposed to do when I go home? There's nothing for me, no one specifically to guide me with these barriers, whether it was employment or housing. I also did a needs assessment before I started the program. I interviewed 75 people who had been at the intersection of carceral experience, and asked them what their greatest need was, and it kept coming back to the same thing, which was housing, employment, and mental health and wellness.
You have multiple counselors on this team. Seems you have a lot of people with very diverse experience. Why did you feel that it was important to bring a wide variety of people into this?
Our original board of directors also were a lot of individuals with lived experience as well. And then same with our staff. So our staff, some of them are from Gainesville, some of them aren't, some of them were incarcerated for a short amount of time, some of them were incarcerated for several years, and then some of them weren't incarcerated at all, but they're really invested. So we really try to have a spectrum of individuals, just like what you see inside of prisons and jails.
How have local officials reacted to these initiatives?
So local officials, I think, very much support reentry. The sheriff is also very supportive of us. He's been here several times. The mayor's been here. Most of the commissioners, city and county. So I feel like we have a lot of support from elected officials.
Is there anything else that you want to share about you or about the initiative as a whole?
Be curious and be compassionate when addressing people, and also look for opportunities to empower folks coming home. This isn't charity. We really try to encourage people to learn how to take care of themselves, to be assertive, and also empathetic. And we need that compassion on both sides.
That was Emily Westerholm, the director of the nonprofit Released Reentry, speaking to WUFT's Stryker Anderson. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. Gilchrist County is very rural and proud of it. So rural, in fact, that there's only one of these in the whole county. Is it A, a traffic light, B, a railroad crossing, or C, a water tower? Stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. It's NPR's Climate Solutions Week this week, where you get to hear how communities across the country are learning to cope with hotter days and stronger storms. Well, Alachua County has a climate solution of its own, one you can find, of all places, in a retirement community in Gainesville. WUFT's Rose Schnabel has more.
The halls of the retirement community, Oak Hammock, are filled with lots of things you'd expect, and one thing you wouldn't. Smiling staff rushing from place to place, residents' artwork covering the walls, and climate migrants in the courtyard.
We absolutely, unequivocally moved to Gainesville because of climate change.
That's Pamela Jones Morton. She moved out of her coastal home in Estero near Fort Myers after hurricanes seemed to get worse and worse.
Even though it was our love, we still had to desert it because there was no way that it was sustainable for us in the future.
Pamela Jones Morton and her wife consider themselves climate migrants. So do a handful of their neighbors and friends. But it's not just retirees. Alachua County expects to welcome more than 23,000 climate migrants from other parts of Florida in the next 75 years. That's on top of the county's normal growth rate, according to modeling by the Bureau of Economic and Business Research at the University of Florida.
How's that going to shape our house prices? How's that going to increase traffic slightly at that one intersection going to Publix, right?
Jesse Keenan is a professor at Tulane University and even wrote a book on climate migration, North, the Future of Post-Climate America. He says people aren't fully aware of what's on the horizon.
They can see it on the periphery. There's one or two extra kids in their kids' classroom, but they're not necessarily thinking about what comes next 5 and 10 years later and what do we need to do to be able to accommodate that growth. Or otherwise, it's going to take us all an hour to get to the grocery store.
But Alachua County is thinking about what comes next. Last year, it became one of the first landlocked communities in Florida to adopt what's known as a climate action plan. It lays out almost 200 action items, like using more buildings as cooling centers and training crisis center staff on the psychological impacts of climate change. That's according to the county's resiliency specialist, Jennison Kipp.
All of that is trying to address this continuous growth while not leaving behind or forgetting about the people who are already here.
If communities don't intentionally plan for growth, Jesse Keenan says, they risk running into climate gentrification. Here's an example he gives. Let's say someone wants to get out of Broward County. Their house costs $800,000. They see a house in Gainesville that runs maybe about $400,000. Then
they'll buy it in cash. They'll bid it up. You know, it drives up rents. It drives up the cost of housing. And that crowds people out.
The people crowded out get pushed to areas with more climate risks.
And we privatize resilience and sustainability as a kind of luxury amenity. And so we need to move our mindset that this can't just be a luxury amenity in housing. This needs to be an opportunity that everybody has.
That change, he says, will take time. Data show one more thing. People displaced by climate change don't move far from where they currently live. Pamela Jones Morton and her wife knew they didn't want to leave Florida. And those 23,000 climate migrants the county expects are from within the state. That trend is likely to continue, driving people from the edges of Florida into the center. Roche Nabel, WUFT News.
This story is a part of NPR's annual Climate Solutions Week. This year, we're looking at local and regional climate solutions as the federal government aggressively walks back policies intended to address global warming. For more of Barb and Pam's story, visit our website at WUFT.org. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Coming up on the show, the University of Florida announced a single finalist in its presidential search again. Who is Dr. Stuart Bell, and what is his experience? That's coming up after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. The University of Florida says they now have a single finalist in the search for a new president. WUFT's Ailey Shaines reports it's the previous president of the University of Alabama.
Dr. Stuart Bell held that position for 10 years. That's according to a UF press release. His background is in engineering. He was the provost and a professor at Louisiana State University and was the dean of the School of Engineering at the University of Kansas. During Bell's time at Alabama, the university achieved R1 research status. That's the highest research classification for a higher education institution. Here's Bell at his last commencement speech as University of Alabama president.
It has been one of my greatest privileges and honors to be a part of this community. And like so many who have come before us and those who will come after us, we've tried to serve with steadiness, with care, and with a deep respect for traditions and for the future.
Bell was also heavily involved in college athletics. He served as the president of the Southeastern Conference from 2023 to 2025. Now the presidential recommendation goes to the UF Board of Trustees for approval. After that, it will need to be confirmed by the Florida Board of Governors. Ailey Shaines, WUFT News.
Florida's legislative leaders are negotiating behind closed doors right now on next year's state budget. Douglas Soule reports the secrecy is normal, but that doesn't mean everyone is happy about it.
There's a special session going on focused on creating a spending plan. At this stage, most lawmakers have returned to their home districts. Legislative leaders remain in the Capitol to figure out differences. As Floridians wait to see a finished budget, Governor Ron DeSantis compares it to the Pope's election process.
These members probably have no idea either what's going on. I mean, it's kind of just like a little cabal of people that kind of like decided, and it's like white smoke coming out of, and so do we have a budget?
Barbara Peterson heads the Florida Center for Government Accountability. She's a transparency advocate and has repeatedly accused the DeSantis administration of not having enough of it, including in court. But she agrees with him on this.
That's very rich coming from the anti-open government governor. I mean, he does the same thing. But yes, it is always been relatively secretive, and we've always complained about it.
There are public meetings, but those are typically short, and only when there's a vote on things decided behind closed doors.
Why they do or don't get money is of critical public importance and interest. And it all happens behind closed doors. That is making a mockery of government in the sunshine.
A Senate spokesperson says the process has not violated any constitutional or Senate rules and notes lawmakers can question and debate during the open meetings. I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Well, today is World Day for Cultural Diversity, and so WUFT's Natalia Marquez asked students at the University of Florida this question. What dish outside of your own culture has become foundational to you? Let's take a listen.
My name is Mary Gerges. I would say empanadas only because I'm from like Miami area, so all my friends are Cuban, and that's all they eat. So I feel like just being around them and obviously eating it with them, like when I'm at their houses, whatever. I don't know, it's interesting because it's just like that family aspect and like being brought into a culture that isn't my own, I enjoy. Like the shell is, I don't know if it's just like a flour tortilla or something. I don't know what it is, but it's really good. Yeah, go try it.
My name is Karina Claros. My roommate is Indian, so I just tried Indian food for the first time, I think a year ago. And it's been super important in my life because I've been able to like blend my cultural experiences with my friends. Usually she'll just order a bunch of different family meals and we'll all kind of just like dig in. It's gotten me, given me the experience to try something new and something that I probably wouldn't have thought to try if like on my own. So it's been very beneficial to just try something new and get this a sense of the world through her lens.
My name is Daniil Poboroznik. I think like arepas, and I never even had like tacos before. Like tacos, it's like all new to me. And my wife, she's a chef, so she is doing all of that for me, so it's amazing. It's probably just something new. It's just very basic, easy to make, and pretty good. You can basically put anything that you like on it, and I think it's gonna taste good. Yeah, I think it's just like the things that I like about it is just like easy to make, and it's pretty cheap to get in Gainesville.
My name is Axel Allenbaugh. I would definitely say butter chicken. I really love the dish. I think it's really good, and I think everyone should try it, even if they don't really like chicken that much. I think they'll really enjoy it. Butter chicken, it's just like this dish that you usually have with rice, I believe, and it's really heavily seasoned chicken with a bunch of different spices. It's not too spicy, so if you don't like spices, you're still good.
Those were UF students talking about a dish from outside their own culture that became foundational to them. This story was produced by Natalia Marquez. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week, Gilchrist County is very rural. So rural, in fact, that there's only one of these in the whole county. Is it A, a traffic light, B, a railroad crossing, or C, a water tower? The answer's coming up at the end of the show, and that's after a quick break, so stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shearmont-Spina. Well, you've likely seen them by now, crawling on your leg, smashing into your windshield, or darting around the sky in pairs. They're love bugs, and they're everywhere. WUFT's Tess Lippincott spoke earlier with University of Florida professor and entomologist Norman Lepla about what exactly is going on.
They just capture people's attention. Doesn't matter if you're an entomologist, but they sure are interesting.
The little black bugs have shown up in swarms across north central Florida within the past month. They are completely harmless, but according to many, they're annoying and even gross. And yes, when you see them, they are attached by their reproductive organs.
People are interested in what makes them fly around and what they do. If they're mating the whole time, they are not. They mate and then they disperse as pairs.
Dr. Lepla's phone has been buzzing with questions.
One of the questions is, how can I avoid them? So that's when I get involved.
And how do you usually answer that question?
Well, there are quite a few ways. First of all, they don't fly at night. So that's an easy way to avoid them. And they're not as active in the early hours of the day or the late hours of the day.
They typically appear about twice a year for just a few weeks in April to May and August to September. Now, Dr. Lepla says he has noticed fewer bugs over the past few years, but this year was definitely an exception.
So I'm going, well, I guess they went away, been too dry, and then boom, this spring they came out and everybody's going, where did they come from? And frankly, I really don't know.
When the bugs meet, it is not instant chemistry. The males will fight each other and the female is very picky about her lifelong partner.
So the males will push each other and they'll push the female, and eventually a male will be accepted by a female, and then he'll hold on, as we all know, so that other males can't push him away and mate with the female.
And that lifelong partnership, it's short. They only live for about 3 to 4 days. During that time, the female will lay as many as 350 eggs. And that's why there are so many love bugs. On top of that, they're selective about where they lay those eggs.
The larvae have to have moist soil. They live on the surface of the soil, usually under decaying vegetation or cow manure or things like that, where they can survive and feed and last until they become adults again.
Those larvae will live in grass, lawns, and pastures for months and months until they emerge for the next love bug season. Oh, and one other recommendation from Dr. Lepla, clean your car.
The combination of love bugs, which is the splatter on the windshield, is their eggs. And those eggs, with UV light from the sun, will eventually damage the paint on the car.
And if you are about to wash your car, he says you don't need a pressure washer. Instead, simply try a wet dryer sheet first to wipe off the insects and then wash the car as normal. Dr. Lepla has also received calls about all kinds of love bug situations, including from brides.
People are having a wedding, and they don't want, you know, the bride's beautiful dress to be covered with love bugs.
Dr. Lepla is a reproductive insect expert. He says love bugs, yes, they're one of Florida's most known nuisances, but to him, these love bugs are the perfect organism to study. Tess Lippincott, WUFT News.
The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made the show possible this week includes Dave Bereswain, Dana Hill, Stryker Anderson, Rose Schnabel, Ailey Shanes, Natalia Marquez, and Tess Lippincott. Special thanks to the Dean of the College, Hub Brown, and Newsroom Director, Ethan Majok. If you want to go back and listen to this episode again, or any of our previous episodes you may have missed, you can find the show in podcast form on WUFT.org/The Rundown, or wherever you get your podcasts. Our trivia question this week was, Gilchrist County is very rural. So rural, in fact, there's only one of these in the whole county. Is it A, a traffic light, B, a railroad crossing, or C, a water tower? The answer? A, a traffic light. The light in question is located in Trenton at the intersection of U.S. Highway 129 and State Road 26. That's it for The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina.